Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our brand new Substack newsletter and website at letitrollpodcast.com. We've got archives of every episode sorted by genre, era, guest, co-host, and mini-series. It's also a great way to support the show if you can afford it. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Today, we're recasting Nate's 2019 discussion with Shelley Sorensen and Christian Swain about the Jim Morrison biography, No One Here Gets Out Alive. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today I've got the distinct pleasure of being joined by two of my colleagues in the Pantheon Podcasting Network. We've got the rock and roll librarian, Shelley Sorensen, and Christian Swain, the major domo of the whole network, and the rock and roll archaeologist. Welcome.
Hi, Nate.
Thanks, Nate.
And today we're going to talk about a classic of rock literature, No One Here Gets Out Alive, by Jerry Hopkins and Danny Sugarman, both of whom are deceased. So this is a perfect way to cover a real cornerstone of rock music literature when we don't have the authors to go to. So thanks so much for coming on and helping us discuss Jim Morrison and the Doors.
I love that we get to make up whatever we want because there's be no dispute from the authors.
Well, you know, some people say that Danny Sugarman and Jerry Hopkins did just that.
Yes, they did, didn't they?
Biography of their dead former acquaintance, and in Sugarman's case, former client. But we'll get to that at the end. Let's just jump right in there. I mean, this is a biography of Jim Morrison. Came out in 1982, I believe, about 11 years after he died. Was an enormous bestseller. I mean, this was in the racks at the airports, at 7-Elevens. This was a trade paperback. It had a picture of Jim Morrison from 1967, shirtless and beautiful, just immortal. It triggered a Rolling Stone cover story, said he's hot, he's sexy, he's dead, and kind of triggered the whole 60s revival that was a big pop culture factor in the 80s. Well, what was it about mid-60s LA that made it such a great place to launch a rock career, Shelley?
Well, you know, at that time in L.A., it was a big TV and movie capital, and was increasingly becoming a music capital as well. And at that time, in 1964, Jim Morrison started studies at the UCLA Film School, and this was what they called, the professors called, the golden age of film at UCLA and in Los Angeles. The faculty included the top directors, and the students included none other than Francis Ford Coppola. So Jim was right there, you know, in the middle of the burgeoning film kind of industry at the time. And on the weekends, he went to Venice Beach, which had been a mecca for the Beat Generation in the 50s, and still to this day, not even in the 80s, but now still has kind of a bohemian tradition. So it was, you know, a ripe kind of time for all these different, you know, movies, TV, music to kind of counter, you know, intra-fertilize, if that's a word, probably not. And you know, I think it was just a, he was in the right place at the right time kind of thing. What do you think, Chris?
Well, I agree with you. I might add, you know, there's been many golden ages in Hollywood, specifically in the early 1960s. You know, there was the French New Wave was definitely in vogue. A lot of experimentalism was going on, both in film and in music. Very avant-garde. And, you know, Jim and his UCLA compatriots, including Ray Kurzweil, were interested in those kind of boundary pushing concepts and ideas. As far as L.A., I think it hit the nail on the head, at least in America, while New York is considered the media capital, certainly at that time. You know, L.A. is where the entertainment business was really still ground zero and has maintained that ever since. And so to be able to take literally the British invasion and digest it and then create a response, naturally, it seems that L.A. was a fitting place for that in the mid-60s.
Yeah, and you had the Byrds and Love on the Sunset Strip. The Byrds broke
specifically,
out,
yeah.
You know, with Columbia Records big in 65, and then Love kind of ruled the scene on the streets for the next couple of years. And that's the band that Jim Morrison wanted to emulate. Like, their whole goal was to be as big as Love. So,
yeah, Arthur Lee and Company. Yeah. And, you know, there were others that didn't quite make it. But, you know, by then, I think the Troubadour was around. You know, obviously, the Whiskey A Go-Go had switched from a dinner supper club, as they used to call them, to something more akin to what we recognize today, the Whiskey being a, you know, a real rock and roll club.
Yeah, it's interesting. Go ahead, Shelley.
Oh, that's one of the things I thought was interesting about how the book described when Jim lived near the L.A. Strip and the Whiskey A Go-Go and Elektra Records is that he had everything there within walking distance, you know, that it was central to the bar and club scene. And he lived with his girlfriend in Laurel Canyon. And so he just... you know, physically, everything was there where he needed it.
Yeah, I think it was Krieger that lived, Robbie Krieger, the guitarist that lived in Laurel Canyon. I think Jim stayed in basically flophouse motels that were within walking distance. Laurel Canyon's yeah. a little
right.
bit of a drive
yeah.
from there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And his girlfriend's apartment. I thought that was in Laurel
yeah.
Canyon, but I guess it was nearer to the Strip, Pamela Corson.
Yeah, she might have been in Laurel Canyon at one point. I wasn't tracking that super closely. But
yeah.
what was it about the America that was ready for Jim Morrison? What was going on in the 60s
wow.
at that point?
That's a big question.
Well, there was so much going on in the 60s, you know, experimentation with LSD and, you know, marijuana, the whole sexual liberation. And I think one thing that Jim and the Doors really, you know, well, Jim was kind of the quintessential person to you know, experience the generation gap, which was huge then. He not only denied his parents' ideas and value, later on he said they were dead. He said they, you know, denied that they even existed. And and then also he read, he was very well read, and his favorite book was Jack Kerouac's novel
On the Road,
and that was like the Beat Generation, and it was published in 57. So all the kids, you know, at that time in the 60s were reading that book. And when Jim lived kind of briefly in Alameda near San Francisco, he came into the city and, you know, frequented City Lights bookshop and read all the Beat poetry, and Ferlinghetti and Ginsberg were favorites of his. So this was all kind of going into the whole revolution of the 60s that he was, you know, pretty much at the forefront of, I think.
Well, let's face it, post-war world is, dominated by America because we're the last man standing. Our culture were the victors. We were hardly touched by the atrocities of 4 years or 6 years of war. We benefited from being the apex culture. And then we began to export that culture, notably films and music. By the time you get in the mid 1960s, America is a dominant technological player. Capitalism is in a battle, a pitched battle with communism. There is a lot of fear and uncertainty because of the bomb, the fact that the idea that humanity had to contemplate that its entire existence could be wiped out in about a 30-minute period, and I think that began to weigh on some of these. As we know, Jim comes from a military family. His dad was a rear admiral in the Pacific Fleet at the time, and was actually inconsequentially involved in the Gulf of Tonkin affair. And, as far as Jim, his being a little bit different than some of his contemporaries, rock and roll was fairly relegated to, subject matter of girls and cars in its early incarnation, the original pioneers. And then, I think it'd be fair to say that Bob Dylan and a few others began to change that, and lyrical content began to become deeper and exploratory. And I think Jim took it in a very, very dark way. I like to think of him as, the real Prince of Darkness, to take that title away from some of the heavy metal guys, notably Ozzy Osbourne, because I think he's the one that really invented, shock rock on a pop scale, on a grand scale. The medium of choice at that time was AM radio. There was no FM radio, and AM radio played whatever was a hit, black, white, rock, pop, country, folk. It didn't matter, one after another. And I think that these guys, along with, the Farfisa, Ray Manzarek keyboard sound, created a sonic difference out there that the kids really gravitated to.
Yeah, and Elektra Records was right there in L.A. too, and they just had a trial run with Love. They put out two Love albums to reasonable success for a band that refused to leave L.A., essentially. And so they couldn't, go to that Sullivan show, et cetera, et cetera, and weren't doing national tours. But Elektra had introduced themselves to the rock market as a middling player. They were already a pretty well-established folk player. So, it was perfect. They had a really aggressive approach to the marketing, putting giant billboards over Sunset Strip with Morrison's very pretty face on it. And, the time was perfect. It was also interesting because it was the last window when the teeny bopper magazines like 16 and Tiger Beat were essentially the only rock press in America. And so you've got this artist that you would now consider alternative or underground. And within just a couple of years, he would have been considered that. The Doors would be the kind of band that would only be on FM radio, that would only put out albums that you might not even see their faces or, much less their leather clad bodies. But instead, Jim Morrison is doing these spreads, these fashion spreads, looking as sexy as all get out and driving the little girls wild. And let's hear the first song that Jim Morrison sang for Ray Manzarek, who was a classmate of his at the UCLA film school. And was a practicing professional semi-pro musician, and Jim had no musical experience. They bumped into each other in the beach, and Jim sang him some of the words to Moonlight Drive.
Let's climb to the moon, let's climb through the tide, penetrate the
evening that the city sleeps too high. Let's swim out tonight, love. It's our turn to try. Heart beside the ocean on our Moonlight Drive.
That was Moonlight Drive, which appeared on the Doors' second album. I can't remember. I think it's Strange Days. I always want to call it People Are Strange, which was the hit single off that album. And listening to that song, it's a perfectly good Doors song, but it's not one lyrically that blows you away, but it blew Ray Manzarek away. And you know, they were off and running. But Shelley, the book, I remember I was a kid, a seventh grader, reading this, totally impressionable, and I would not let my seventh grader read this book. but what did... And I remember just being horrified at what I just thought he was the jerk of all time. What did you feel about Jim Morrison from the way the book tells his life story?
Well, you know, actually the most I knew about Jim Morrison before I read this book was the Oliver Stone movie that was, I guess, was based on this book, right?
Yeah.
I wasn't a Doors fan, and I didn't buy Doors albums. I was, I was born in 57. So, you know, I remember being in junior high school and hearing their music, but, I wasn't attracted to them, as a band or him as a musician. And this book purports to, you know, it tells all about basically, you know, that he was an alcoholic from the time he was a teenager. And I think, you know, it's very warts and all about his drug and alcohol use, about his treatment of his friends, about his treatment of women. I don't think it helped me feel more kindly toward Jim Morrison, even though the writers say they describe him, you know, his more sensitive side and as a poet and a visionary and somebody that was very important to the rock and roll music scene. It didn't really kind of change my mind about him, you know, as a person kind of being a selfish, self-centered, you know, alcoholic. I don't know, you know, his upbringing was, you know, he was raised by these very conservative parents, as Christian was saying. His father was in the military and his mother was the perfect military mother, you know, and wife. They moved frequently and she kept house and, you know, they weren't abused or, you know, anything like that. But Jim was totally an excessive person, even as a child. And, you know, kind of tortured his siblings in a loving way. And then, you know, and then was nice to them and, you know, really did extreme dangerous things. So, I don't think it was the rock and roll lifestyle that turned him into an alcoholic, like you might have seen on The Star Is Born or something like that. And I think that, you know, he just rejected his parents out and out. Just because he was as a symbol of authority, I think, by the time he was, you know, he had moved out of the house, he didn't even speak to them again.
Oh, he would tell interviewers that they were dead.
Right. And that was on the first liner notes of the first record, that he had no parents. They were dead. Christian knows my story, but I sympathize more with his mother than I do with him. as a mother of an alcoholic who rejects, you know, their family, it's just a very painful. Anyway, so I didn't come away from the book with kind of a better impression of Jim as a person, but maybe more respect for him as a poet and a lyricist, I would say. That's my
and
Jim is obviously a complicated man. Childish, manipulative, interested intensely on the darker aspects of life, and obviously had demons that he couldn't work out, and self-medicated himself to death. But as a good artist, he was able to tap into that and present that in a public manner that connected with a large audience and exposed some of these feelings, which I don't think had been really explored in popular music up until that time.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that struck me rereading this, 40 years after I read it the first time, was the importance of his theatrical and film background and also how intellectual he was. Of all the musicians, I've researched in the couple years I've been doing this project, the only one with an education comparable is Bing Crosby, who went to a Catholic law school and read all the great philosophers. Jim Morrison is an incredibly well-educated person.
Oh yeah.
Who read all this philosophy and probably took himself a little bit too seriously, but I think he's also unique and innovative in that he was self-consciously analyzing the rock scene. And he had been a fan of Elvis Presley as a kid, but he wasn't a greasy haired rocker. He was not somebody who was a singer from day one and out in the clubs and, singing. And he wasn't a folk singer like, Jerry Garcia or the Byrds, or, he wasn't playing in Latin bars like Skip Spence or Moby Grape. I mean, he was an intellectual. He was a film student, and pretty bad film student, it seems like. Like, he washed out of UCLA completely, but really understood something about how to manipulate crowds. Like, I sort of forgave him for his being such a manipulative jerk with everybody he knew when I realized that became his art. That was what he was doing. He was just experimenting with this idea of control. And he clearly had awesome powers in that direction. And that kind of is, I think, what bit him in the ass. I mean, he got everything he wanted so fast with the Doors. They're quickly succeeding on the club circuit in LA, quickly signed to a label. There's a brief delay in getting a hit single. Their first single flops, but their second one is a monster. And boom, he's all his dreams of having a platform from which to pontificate and manipulate audiences, comes true. And then it's like, wow, was that worth,
Yeah, be careful. Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. But Shelly, tell us a little bit about the other members of the band and like what you felt about them as personalities and the way they're presented in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was very interesting the way they all met. You already talked about how he met Ray in the film school and then, on the beach, and Ray just went, well, that's the best. Those are the greatest fucking song lyrics I've ever heard. Let's start a rock and roll band and make $1 million. Quickly, I mean, it was like Ray discovered Jim. Nobody else discovered Jim. Ray discovered Jim and said, you want to be in our band, in the band that he was in already? And Jim said, I don't play anything. And he said, just hold the guitar, on stage. And that's how he got his start on stage. But one of the things I thought was interesting was that John Densmore, the drummer, Ray met in his meditation class. And then John introduced Robbie Krieger to them, who he had met in his meditation class. So they were all meditators, which I thought was really interesting for rock musicians.
And, except for Jim. Jim never partook.
No, right. No, they were, the three others were meditators, which was probably the only way they could put up with him. They were all musicians and played a variety of music. John Densmore played jazz drumming in college. And Ray Krieger played Segovia and folk blues. Flamenco. I dictated my notes.
That's John Waters, Pink Flamingo.
Yeah. And And in fact, he played bottleneck guitar so nicely that Jim wanted him to play kind of exclusively bottleneck on most of his first songs. And so they were, you know, actual musicians. And yeah, I thought that was really interesting that that they were all meditators.
Yeah, it's a very late 60s yeah. thing to be doing in the mid 60s. They're all kind of ahead of their time there.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I don't remember anybody
LA.
Meditating.
Yeah.
LA was always ahead of its time for that sort of thing, you know. The land you guys are in the land of fruits and nuts here, because both Shelly and I are born and raised in California.
Hey. Yeah,
it's true. It's like the cult villains in every Raymond Chandler novel. There's always
come on down, man. Yep.
Oh, actually, I did learn to meditate in junior high school. I went to kind of a hippie school. Yeah. We did transcendental meditation. That was.
Yeah, I think Esalen was up and running by 65 too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, and by then Alpert and Leary had been kicked out of Harvard and were looking for some place to go. I think they were mostly in Mexico at that particular moment. But by 64, 65, Ken Kesey has gone through the MK Ultra experiments performed by the CIA and discovered that this little drug that they were handing out was really cool without the CIA, and started stealing some from the pharmacists at the mental institution he was working at and researching his upcoming book, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and then started handing it out to his buddies, mostly musician friends, who then they started to share it with their musician friends. And so by 65, 66, the world is turned on its head for those who have indulged in the experiment from Mr. Albert Hoffman.
And let me jump in and cue another song. This is Brecht and Viles. Alabama Song, which is a completely crazy song for a rock band to cover in 1967. It was a cabaret show tune from decadent Berlin in the 1920s. And Brecht, you know, the radical communist creator of the alienation effect and all these intellectual theories. So, you know, the Doors have been dinged for pretentiousness for covering this, but I think they managed to sew it into their oeuvre pretty nicely. This is the Alabama Song.
Don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why. Show me the way to the next whiskey bar. Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why. For if we don't find the next whiskey bar, I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die. I tell you.
And that was Jim Morrison and the Doors saying Brecht and Viles' Alabama Song, which, I mean, must have blown minds in the 60s. And most kids, like I know, I had no idea who Brecht and Viles were until I heard this song and read Rolling Stone panning the Doors for being pretentious for covering it. And that led me off on a whole voyage of discovery. And I'm sure lots of people.
Well, I don't think you need to go to that song. I mean, just the name of the band, you know, taken from Aldous Huxley's The Doors of Perception is evidence enough of some sort of pretentiousness.
Absolutely.
I have a question for you guys, though. But certainly in Germany, it wasn't called the Alabama Song, right? I mean, I didn't know that about that song, that it was a Brecht tune. Why is it called the Alabama Song?
I believe it was called the Alabama Song. I should have wikied it up before. Christian, you know, I can pull up really quick. But it's part of the Three Penny Opera. And, Alabama had a worldwide infamous reputation as a slave capital. So I'm sure it was I think it was just a well-known, I think it was just a commentary on America. It's also called Moon of Alabama, I think.
I see. Okay.
And also Whiskey Bar.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was translated.
Oh, show me the way to the next whiskey bar.
Yeah, and it was from the play Little Mahogany, not the Three Penny Opera.
And
it was translated by the English lyrics were written by Elizabeth Hauptmann in 1925.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, they were just into crazy, weird stuff. It began as a German poem and translated by their purposes. But, you know, they were like that movie Cabaret, basically. It was the whole decadent Weimar Republic thing and stuff. But I found when I went back and listened to the whole Doors catalog, I thought it held up pretty well, especially, you know, compared to their, you know, the Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead and other California bands from class of 67. You know, I think, you know, Rolling Stone infamously in the 80s just hated the Doors. I think they gave their first album 3 stars and everything else less. And then, you know, by the time, Dave Marsh, of all people, who, you know, is quoted in the early 70s praising some of their albums in the book, turned pretty viciously on him, I think influenced by Robert Christgau and my friend Ed Ward, who still hates the Doors. But, you know, by the 90s edition of the Rolling Stone Record Guide, they'd thrown in the towel and declared them one of the three apocalyptic California bands of the 60s, along with the Beach Boys and the Grateful Dead. And I, you know, to me, like when Ed starts dissing the Doors, I just say, well, you know, Patti Smith and Iggy Pop thought they were a pretty big deal. I think the world cares more about what they thought than what a bunch of rock critics thought.
Yeah. Well, as somebody who was born in San Francisco, grew up in L.A., and has lived in San Francisco in the Bay Area for over 40 years, I think as far as California goes, there was a divide in the kind of music that was going on. And I just to tell you kind of a personal anecdote, my husband, who's older than me and was 17, 18 in San Francisco in 1967, when I told him I was covering the Doors on this podcast, he said, you know, in San Francisco, he said, no one liked the Doors. He said he heard Light My Fire and he knew instantly it would be a hit, but he didn't like it. And none of his friends liked it. And they were all into, you know, seeing Hendrix and Janis Joplin and Mike Bloomfield and, you know, and the Grateful Dead at the Fillmore. And, you know, it was a very different aesthetic, certainly than the Doors. And, you know, he said, whereas Hendrix was a musical genius, they just thought that Morrison was a drunk singer, you know, and I know that's not true.
A drunk cabaret singer.
Yeah.
And that's obviously not true of all of San Francisco, because when they came to San Francisco, they were very well received, you know, at the Fillmore and
by the public
at
itself.
The Avalon.
Yeah. But let me jump in here and just say, look, there's a huge difference in the mid 60s between the L.A. Musicians and that sound versus the San Francisco sound. You know, there's a reason why the free speechers at Berkeley hated the fucking hippies because they wouldn't get off their ass and do anything worthwhile. And from the hippies' perspective, they were like, no, man, you know, we want to explore everything. And, you know, most famously encapsulated by, you know, the music of the Grateful Dead, which, you know, as they grew, you know, it was experimental, you know, it was open, it was loose, whereas, you know, L.A., you know, was a professional organization. In fact, you know, most of the bands that we think of out of L.A. had some form of studio players on them, you know, most famously recognized now as the Wrecking Crew, including the Doors. You know, they didn't have a bass player. And when they needed a bass player, they pulled in some of those great studio cats down in Southern California. So there was a level of professionalism that really existed down in L.A. that did not exist in L.A., in San Francisco. And there was a real separation between those two camps at that particular moment. Now, of course, you know, this all begins to gel and become, you know, looking back at history, it seems like, you know, well, there's this California moment, but there were two very distinct camps at the time.
Yeah. And it's interesting, his interactions, you know, it talks about him seeing the Jefferson Airplane and not liking them later on. And it talks about him hanging out with Janis Joplin and, really being abusive and awful to her, which was exactly the kind of thing she was drawn to. You know, they were peas in a pod. She's looking to be humiliated and abused, and he's looking to dish it out. So those two, you know, of course, a volatile chemical mix. And he also, there's a mention of him seeing Hendrix. I can't remember where. And you know, crawling up to the stage and grabbing Hendrix by the knees and ankles, you know, to you know, supplicate himself to the greatness of Hendrix. So, you know, there are definitely, those currents and rivalries with San Francisco. And I think that the fact that Rolling Stone magazine was in San Francisco just sort of
that doesn't help the LA crowd, does it?
No. And they definitely flew that flag. I mean, Rolling Stone, if you're familiar with the history of their editorial practices, were very partisan. You know, they loved John Lennon and Yoko. They hated Paul McCartney. They loved the Grateful Dead. Mm. You know, they didn't so much like the Doors, although they turned on the Dead too. But you know, this thing about Morrison as a manipulator, and you know, he obviously manipulated his audiences, but at the beginning he was a very skillful manipulator of the press. But then mm-hmm. he changes in the way, you know, he behaves toward the press and sort of self-sabotages. Do you think that was just a function of him being too alcoholic to do his job, or was that sort of a philosophical switch when he'd become disillusioned with the whole machinery of success and stardom?
Yeah, I would say disillusion is definitely a factor, you know, coupled with, you know, massive self-medication. You have no patience, you know, when you've been asked the same question hundreds of times.
Right. And I think, you know, the manipulating the press was hard work. I mean, you had to.
It is hard work.
You had to think about it, and you had to come up, you know, he came up with great quotes and, you know, really defined his image in the press by, you know, coming out with these lengthy philosophical things like "think of us as erotic politicians." That was one of his quotes. And he, you know, like you said, he was really into being photographed too, and, you know, wore, you know, a fur coat and jewelry and cut his hair like Alexander the Great. In fact, I thought it was interesting that in junior college, he took a class on collective behavior, which was the psychology of crowds. And he learned how to, was trying to tell his friends how interesting that was and how they could, you know, look at a crowd and make love to it and cure it and make it riot. And his friends all thought he was nuts, but obviously that was something he used to great effect in his public performances too.
And let me jump in and cue the next song, and then we'll return to that and talk about how he manipulated crowds basically to destroy his own career. But let's first hear Love's Treat. And this is the spoken word bridge of the song, so we can hear Jim Morrison, the poet, backed by a rock band. This is Love's Treat by the Doors.
There's the store where the creatures meet. Wonder what they do in there. Summer Sunday and a year. I guess I like it fine so far.
And that was Love Street by Jim Morrison and the Doors. And, you know, listening to back, I mean, he's taken a lot of critical bricks and brackets for being pretentious and a, quote, bad poet and everything. But to me, when I listen to that, it holds up comparable to like Allen Ginsberg guesting with The Clash or something. I really hear the influence of the Beats, and it doesn't. It doesn't ruin the song at all or the record. It fits right in. I mean, something like Hoarse Latitudes or Celebration of the Lizards, a little different, especially when Celebration of the Lizard goes on for 10 minutes on the live album, but, you know, not so bad. But let me let you get back to what you're talking about, Shelley, and the whole way. Tell a tale of how he deliberately attempted to instigate a riot in Miami and what the fallout of that was.
Right. He, you know, he wanted to, he didn't tell the other band members he was going to do this, but he really wanted to you know, expose himself and see what would happen if he did that. And, you know, and then the story goes back and forth. Did he really expose himself, or did he just make it look like he did? And one of the reasons he did that was that he didn't like the, you know, he was getting tired of the adulation that he was getting, this crowd mentality that he had actually created. But then he realized it was going too far, and he couldn't just be himself and be a poet, and he wanted to put a stop to it. So he really purposely sabotaged his career by doing that. And then, of course, he got, you know, charges pressed against him for indecent exposure. And that trial went on for a really long time. And he was banned by many venues, you know, to play. And when they let him come back and play, when they let the Doors come back and play, they had to put up huge amounts of money as bond, you know, to in case the concert was canceled or, you know, or interrupted by the police or something like that, or in case he did something else obscene. So yeah, he really did, you know, grind their career. You know, of course it came back up slowly but surely and to a great degree, but he really put a pause on their career there for a while by doing that.
Well, I think some of the output wasn't stellar as well. I also think, you know, music trends were changing rapidly. There was some catch up in that. Let's face it, as we said at the top, you know, Jim wasn't a trained musician or, you know, took an interest in what that professional lifestyle is and what it means. You know, as Nate, you said, you know, the rise to stardom was so fast that it's very easy to see, you know, a rejection of that, especially for someone who, you know, and if I can, you know, Jim was not born, you know, a Greek god. He was actually rather average and a little chubby through his elementary school years. He didn't blossom until his college age and started to get attention for his attractiveness and his outgoing personality, manipulative or what have you. But he was and always did consider himself a writer and desired to be a poet. And that lifestyle is one of the internal, not the external, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the most sympathetic things I thought that the authors did in the book, that they pointed out he did walk it like he talked it. He didn't buy a mansion. He didn't buy a private plane. He, you know, he never had big cars. That basically he never had anything beyond a week's worth of clothes, a six pack of beer, and a handful of books at any given time. And he would be floating from, you know, these flop house motels to various girlfriends' apartments. And, you know, he's living basically the Charles Bukowski lifestyle, just with the rock star budget.
Right.
So, you know,
yeah. he wasn't materialistic.
No.
Yeah. In fact, yeah. I like how when in the beginning, well, at least the edition I had, one reviewer describes him not the cliches of rise and fall, of corruption by wealth and fame, but of a sudden burning out of a volatile, spoiled, gifted, intelligent, artistic individual. So he, you know, like I said before, he wasn't ruined by fame like so many other rock and roll musicians, like, you know, how they're kind of okay, but then they get turned by their fame, you know, to excess and wasting of money and getting in tax debt and all that stuff, and getting addicted to drugs and alcohol. That was the way he was. He was already addicted to drugs and alcohol, and he wasn't attracted by wealth and materialism at all. He was attracted by art. And I think I agree with you that is one redeeming feature of Jim Morrison for me.
Well, let me add something to that, Shelley. Great point. You know, as Morrison becomes more confident on stage and they grow as an act, Jim's concept, which was different than the other three, was to inject more, let us call it, performance art into the live shows and try to take them into, you know, some festival of Dionysus or what have you to get the audience to, you know, get out of themselves and experience, you know, a true art happening at the time.
Yeah, and he also had the whole, you know, you talked about the drop in quality of their albums, and it's very clear their third and fourth album, you know, are not as great as their first and second or their last two. And his attempt to record this Celebration of the Lizard suite, which, you know, is a 10-minute plus full album long side concept of a suite of poems, you know, set to music. It was very ahead of its time. He was aiming to do something that the prog rockers would be doing, you know, in just a few years, but they couldn't pull it off. And it kind of reminds me of, you know, Pete Townsend's Lighthouse experiment
that was supposed
to be this whole, you know, multimedia movie concept thing. And it implodes, but they managed to salvage the songs and create their masterpiece, Who's Next? And for the Doors, they kind of had to stumble along without, you know, they didn't have the book of songs. The Celebration of the Lizard is not several great rock songs. You know, it was a suite that was either going to work as a whole or not work at all. They did manage to perform it live. But their comeback is sort of, it's driven by Robbie, and especially Robbie. I think Robbie Krieger is a way underpraised performer and songwriter. He wrote
Agree.
Light My Fire and
right.
Hello, you know,
that's his first song.
Yeah. And so many of their pop hits, you know, Don't You Love Her Madly, et cetera, et cetera. He's the pop songwriter, but Jim's songwriting grows too. And so, you know, they're a great team with Robbie writing the AM single hit, and then Jim coming up with stuff like LA Woman, which is a long form song that does work in a rock context. So they were able to respond to, you know, the innovations of Led Zeppelin and the band and everything with these last two albums that come back and really, you know, put down a marker for the Doors as a serious quality hard rock band, and you know, and won back a lot of the critics, at least at the time. And let's go ahead and hear one of those songs. Let's hear Peace Frog, which was got music by Robbie Krieger and lyrics by Jim Morrison. Frog from Morrison Hotel, which many people saw as a comeback album and an attempt by the Doors to reestablish their rock credibility. And I have to say, I don't generally get into rock criticism because it's not the point of the show, but I have to say, I think it holds up very well with the material put out by their peers at the time. And I recently saw David Crosby get in on Twitter and dissing the Doors, and it made me want to slap his face. Like, how dare you? You could not touch them at their best. I mean, Crosby did what Crosby did with the Byrds and Crosby, Stills, and Nash, which is great, you know, inventing folk rock and inventing, you know, soft rock and all that. But he never was a credible hard rocker, and the Doors, I think really were. I mean, how do you guys rate them? Like, do you think they hold up? I mean, the whole idea of he's redeemed because of his commitment to art. If he's a charlatan and a fake, there's nothing redemptive about that. But if you think he made something lasting, then it is redemptive. What do you think?
Right. I agree. I don't think he's a charlatan and a fake at all. And I think the songs hold up. And
yeah, the
I
opposite.
I
find them incredibly authentic. Go ahead, Shelley.
Oh, I was just going to say Peace Frog is one of my favorites.
It actually has a bass line
on it, which I'm always attracted to good bass lines. And I was telling Christian before we went on air that may be one reason that I wasn't particularly like moved by the Doors music when I was a teenager, because I didn't hear a lot of bass on the records. I've just in retrospect, I'm thinking that may be one of the things, but I think the music, I mean, you know, I don't recognize the titles of the songs. And so when I went back to listen to a lot of them, I was like, oh, I know all of these. I mean, I'm familiar with all of the songs, even though I never had a Doors album. I never owned a Doors album.
I think that says a lot right there.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. What were you going to say, Christian?
Oh, you know, just to add on to you know, their worth and their influence to later works. I think certainly at the time, you know, they, you know, were the darkest band before there really were, you know, dark bands which, you know, came on the horizon. I mean, it, you know, Black Sabbath doesn't even show up till 1970, and as we know now, you know, their imagery and motifs were, you know, based on fantasy, on Hammer horror films. You know, this was about you know, selling a comic book version of themselves, and you know, Morrison was everything that you got. You know, most of it not great, but some of it sublime. I find him one of the most authentic characters to ever come out of rock and roll.
Yeah, and I think one of the best ways to measure the power of a musical artist is by their influence, and the fact that essentially all hard rock singers going forward are either going to be influenced by the Golden Boy Robert Plant or the Prince of Darkness, Jim Morrison. And you get, you know, yeah, Ian Asbury of the Cult and Glenn Danzig of the Misfits and Danzig and et cetera, et cetera. Iggy Pop based his whole act on Jim Morrison. And for some reason, you know, because Iggy is seen as punk and Jim is classic rock, there people miss that connection, but it's a direct, absolutely direct chain and handoff. But let's talk about the book before we wrap up. What do you guys think about the book? I mean, it's very salacious. You know, it goes out of its way to mention him butt fucking groupies, excuse the terminology, but that's what they talk about, you know. And then
they write a song called Backdoor Man.
Well, they covered the song, but
yes, you're right. I'm sorry, that is a cover,
and presumably Howlin' Wolf was talking about knocking on a girl's back door while her husband's away, but you know. Regardless,
I don't think that's what Jim had in mind. For sure.
It's clearly not, and it's a very salacious book. I mean, it's clearly written. It's full of pictures. I mean, it's a great trade paperback. It's right up there with like Vince Bugliosi's Helter Skelter as far as lurid portraits of LA in the late '60s. But I mean, do you feel like they went over the line and they were unfair to the artists, or is this just sort of the perfect way to summarize a pop phenomenon?
You know, as a librarian, I know a little something about biographies, and this one reminded me of the fact that, you know, I was a children's librarian for a long time, and we started consciously weeding out books, biographies that were fictionalized in the way this book is. So the way it's written, it makes it more salacious than if it were just written in a more of a nonfiction style, because they take interviews with people, but they weave them in as quotes about, like, a lot of the book is dialogue that's either quoted from people's interviews but not attributed. So it makes it, if you weren't like a savvy reader, you would be like, oh yeah, this actually happened this way. These people had this exact conversation, which, you know, can't possibly be true unless it was recorded, you know, that the person was in the room when the conversation happened, because this is one person's telling of how the conversation went, which is obviously, you know, tinted in the way that person remembers it. And that, I think that adds like 50% to the salaciousness, as you say, of the book, that it reads like a novel really more than a nonfiction factual, you know, biography.
Well, remember, Jerry Hopkins had written the book or a manuscript years before and had tried to get it published and was unsuccessful at it, until he brought Danny Sugarman in to add quite a bit of the salaciousness, first person type of accounts. Yeah. And to Shelley's point, you know, as we know, memory is somewhat fallible, and especially after a decade or so, where, you know, you begin to mythologize your past. And, let's face it, by this time, Morrison is a mythological creature, and Sugarman's memories are probably couched and clouded in those external responses coming to him, right. And of course, I think the book proves the point in that, Jerry Hopkins tried to get this sold. Nobody would sell it until they turned it into something more salacious and palatable to, right. A buying public. And sure enough, it did the trick, didn't it?
It's kind of like reading the National Enquirer. I mean, especially to the point of Danny Sugarman's memories, he was a teenager when a lot of this happened, right?
Yes, he was.
You know, so like if I told you like dialogue that happened from when I was a teenager, how accurate would that be? So this is more like a magazine article. Or,
yeah,
I don't know.
Danny began working with the Doors when he was 12.
Right.
That's crazy. And so many of the scenes happen in the offices of the Doors, and it's clearly that's where he's interacted with Jim. Stuffing envelopes or whatever.
Yeah, imagine you're 12 and Jim Morrison is your buddy. What the fuck would that be like, you know?
That's even weirder than reading this biography when you're 12, being part of the biography when you're 12.
Much, much weirder, yes.
Yeah,
so I mean, so there's some questions there, but I mean, I think it to me ultimately it's a net positive for Jim and the Doors because it cemented their legacy as great stars.
Yeah, it did, didn't it? there's that. Obviously, gained the attention of Oliver Stone, who went on to make a film about them, which is also debated on.
Yeah.
It's a good thing or a bad thing, but just like Jim, and again, I keep going back to the fact that Morrison himself was a complicated person. Think of his upbringing with a rising star in the United States Navy at the time, the conservative family and those values, and then the rejection of that to the point where you try to eliminate the history of your association with that family. So, I mean, that tells you, I think, all you need to know where to begin with who this cat was. And he comes about right as this new, popular art form is beginning to really take over the entertainment airwaves, and presents himself as the dark Elvis Presley. So, I mean, it all makes sense to me.
Yeah. And his timing was so brilliant. I think it's very telling that the thing that triggered his cutting off communication with his parents was a letter they wrote criticizing his concept of becoming a singer based on the fact that he never evinced any musical talent whatsoever, which is a totally reasonable thing for parents to say. But he, was so confident in what he was doing and was just not going to brook any criticism. And as somebody, a failed musician myself, I see that's the difference between a successful musician and a failure, is somebody who's like, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. I'm not going to hear any negativity. I'm going to associate with people that support my vision, and I'm going to go for it. And, fuck you. And the scene when his mom and younger brother do go to one of their concerts, and he makes a point of screaming the lyrics of the end, which is, mother, I want to fuck you, right in her face. I mean, that had to have been completely shattering for her.
Right.
I mean, what an awful thing to do to your mother.
And that she even wanted to see him after that. I mean, she tried to see him with his little brother in tow, and he evaded her, and he got everyone in the hotel and the concert venue to say, no, Jim's over there. No, Jim's over there, and protect him from this horrible woman that had come to see him, in performance, and withstood that situation happening to her. And she still wanted to see her son, and he never saw her again after that.
Yeah. It's very sad. And to me, it just sort of reinforces you know, this kind of success, both commercially and critically, comes at a high price. And
well,
he gleefully paid it.
Let me add that, I don't think that a singular letter stating that maybe you shouldn't go down this career path would cause quite a reaction. There had to have been a whole lot of shit behind that to get to this. Maybe that was the straw that broke the camel's back, but I think the divorce to his immediate family was probably deeper than just questioning his abilities as a musician. The other thing that I might add is, Nate, like you, I interview a lot of rock stars, and to your point, I've heard over and over again that, you know, when you get right down to it, there was no plan B. I mean, that's what you have to do to be able to make it. There is only plan A, and plan B is being homeless.
Right. Unless you're Mick Jagger at the London School of Economics. But
if you start off with that behind you.
No plan B, and also the besides the not brooking criticism and going with people that support you, is being able to withstand great discomfort.
Yeah.
And, you know, and not knowing what the future holds and not having any security. That stands out for me in all the biographies I've read. Is not caring about security, which is why I was never a musician.
Let's say that this is anathema to to the previous generation, who had to go through things like the Great Depression and World War II, and now here comes this generation of Americans who just given the middle finger to that whole world that those people, you know, quote unquote, created, the corporate society and the organization man and what have you, they just said, no, we don't have to live this way. And I reject that. And to the point of, no, I reject you as a person and I don't even want to see you anymore. So there's a lot going on with the interactions with his family that tells us a lot about who Morrison was.
For sure. And I feel like we've covered the story of Jim Morrison and the Doors. Christian, Shelley, thanks so much for coming on. You can listen to these guys on the Rock and Roll Librarian and Rock and Roll Archaeology. Sorry for my pronunciation. They're both on the Pantheon Podcast Network, which Let It Roll is proud to be a member of. So thanks for coming on the show, guys.
We're glad to have you, Nate. Yeah. And thanks for having us on your show.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Monday, Nate continues his Brian Jones obsession with a discussion of Alan Clayton's book, Brian Jones. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com. Pantheon.com. Code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.